Welcome to this Touch Podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Neurology. This podcast aims to provide caregiver and healthcare professional insights on the importance of making an early diagnosis and initiating symptomatic treatments, including transdermal options, for patients with Alzheimer's disease. Professor George Grossberg, a world-renowned expert in Alzheimer's disease, is joined in conversation by Ms. Susan Miller, an Alzheimer's caregiver advocate, to address real-world questions on optimizing outcomes in Alzheimer's disease through effective diagnosis, treatment, and supportive measures. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Corium Inc. and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, and welcome to this activity on optimizing outcomes for patients with Alzheimer's disease. I'm Dr. George Grossberg. I'm professor and director of the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at St. Louis University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri. Joining me today is Ms. Susan Miller. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
Alzheimer's caregiver advocate who's based in San Diego, California. In addition to her public speaking and her advocacy work, Susan has authored and published a book in which she shares her experiences and insights on caring for loved ones living with Alzheimer's disease. Welcome again, Susan. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So just to kind of review for all of us what we're going to be discussing today, as part of our conversation, we're going to explore the unmet needs of patients and their caregivers to help us kind of better understand how we can optimize outcomes for patients or people living with Alzheimer's disease. After reflecting on the importance of early diagnosis and treatment, we'll look at current symptomatic treatment options, which can be either tablets, capsules, newer transdermal patches as an example. And then we will also discuss how we can better address shared management needs in Alzheimer's disease for improved outcomes. So our first section is going to deal with optimizing outcomes in Alzheimer's disease, overcoming barriers, and addressing symptomatic treatment needs. In this graphic, we look at kind of a relatively new concept vis-a-vis Alzheimer's disease, and that's the notion of Alzheimer's disease being a continuum. We start with the preclinical phase of Alzheimer's disease, where there may be already biomarker evidence of the disease in the brain, but there aren't any symptoms, and the individual clinical symptoms, and the individual is very independent in their activities of daily living. When we get to the stage of mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease, they're still independent in their activities of daily living, but they may be beginning to experience some short-term memory and recall, some soft cognitive changes, but they don't yet meet criteria for dementia. Once they begin to need assistance with activities of daily living, then we move into the dementia arena, whether mild or moderate or more severe or advanced Alzheimer's disease. And let's keep in mind that these activities of daily living impairments can also be accompanied by a variety of psychological as well as behavioral impairments or symptoms. Now here we're looking at what I call the key stages in the journey to a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. What we know is at least at the present time, the vast majority of older adults with memory or cognitive issues go to their family doctor, their primary healthcare provider. It's gonna be their job to kind of figure out and to detect what's going on. They may be doing a variety of assessments. We'll talk about those. They're gonna hopefully come up with an appropriate diagnosis and also provide treatment. But sometimes cases may be complicated, or they're not responding to treatment, in which case referral to a specialist for those more complicated cases may in fact also be a good idea. What we know from community surveys, unfortunately, is that in primary care, more than 50% of patients, older adults with cognitive issues, are not recognized. So the failure to diagnose and diagnose early can result in suboptimal treatment and care, and may result in delay or incorrect therapies and inaccurate information being given to patients and families about the disease as well as prognosis with the disease. So let me start off with a question for you, Susan. Could you maybe share with us your own experiences leading to a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease for your husband?
Yes, I would love to do that. My husband was in his early to mid-50s. He'd lost a job. He got another job. He held that job for 2 years. He lost that job. Along the way, I was noticing changes in his behavior. As the years progressed on, he was less interested in looking for a job, just sat at home, watched CNN, and I was getting frustrated. So I would take him to the family doctor when it was time for a physical and say, please check him out. I think something's wrong. Something just doesn't seem right. And the family doctor always said, he's fine, he's fine. I would mention it to friends saying, have you noticed any difference in my husband? He just doesn't seem to be himself. And everybody would say, fine. And if I mentioned it to my children, they got very annoyed with me and they would say, Dad is fine, Mom. He just lost his job. Leave him alone. He's fine. So this went on for numerous years. And finally, I just couldn't do it anymore. So I went back to the family doctor and I said, something's wrong with him. And again, he said, he's fine. He's fine. And I said, but he's not. I'm telling you, the man is not fine. So send us to a psychologist. So we go to the psychologist. My husband has a 45-minute visit, and the psychologist says, he's fine. I got to hate that word, he's fine. So I don't know where this came from, but I turned to the psychologist and I said, he's not fine, humor me, please do an IQ test. So they did an IQ test, they scored it, and about a week later, we got a phone call saying, there's something wrong, you need to see a neurologist. So that's how our journey began.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Susan. A motto that I use in my practice, when older adults come with family and there's some concern by the family member about memory or cognitive changes in their loved one, is that the family is always right. They know
Thank
that there's
you.
Something wrong.
I wish I had you
And
then.
Of course you were right, and you knew there was something wrong, but it's hard to convince the healthcare system about that. And that can be very frustrating. Now, let me pose a second question for you. When your husband did receive that initial diagnosis, how soon were you able to access treatment, and what were your expectations relative to treatment?
Well, when we had the initial diagnosis, we still had to go through a series of tests and exams to rule other possible, like a brain tumor or syphilis or something else that it could be. So that probably took another month. And they even did a spinal tap. Then we got the diagnosis. Now, it was a combination of excitement and fear. Excitement that, all right, we knew now what was wrong. There was about 14, 15 things out in the pipeline, treatment plans that could possibly work. So we were excited about that. We were optimistic and naive that we could beat this. But at the same time, and I would vacillate back and forth, I was totally overwhelmed. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a long journey. How am I going to get through this? How am I going to work? What happens to my career? What happens to us? So it was a very intense period in the beginning.
Thank you for that.
You know, I'm interested, Professor Grossberg, really in understanding today what a journey looks like for people seeking a diagnosis.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, Susan, is that the journey isn't all that different today. Unfortunately, as we mentioned earlier, patients are not diagnosed early enough, even though we have a lot of tools in our toolbox to be able to more accurately and to provide kind of an earlier diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And let me kind of share, you know, some of those tools with you. I think you'd be interested in kind of looking at these as well as our audience. So we have tools to kind of better detect Alzheimer's disease. And most important, obviously, in early detection is what we mentioned earlier, is to know that the family is always right, that if they notice that there's something wrong cognitively in their loved one, we need to get a detailed history from both the patient as well as the reliable informant. Very important to see if there's a family history on that person's side of dementia or Alzheimer's disease. Very important to review medications that can impair cognition, to do kind of a head-to-toe physical and neurological exam, basic and specialized blood work, looking for reversible factors. We don't routinely do genotyping at the present time, but that's moving to the forefront. Very important to do some type of quantifiable cognitive assessment, whether it's the St. Louis University Mental Status, which is widely used in the US, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, also widely used, as well as others. Also important to see how functional the person is, what functions they've lost, to have the family fill out an activities of daily living inventory, and to screen for behaviors and mood using the NPI or the PHQ for depression. Now, we do recommend one time doing some type of neuroimaging, at least a CAT scan, preferably an MRI. PET scanning is not part of the recommendation guidelines because it's not reimbursed currently by insurance, whether it's FDG PET or amyloid PET. As you mentioned, your husband had spinal fluid testing that is reimbursed by insurance and can give us, I think, a greater confidence in a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But the future is really blood-based biomarkers, which are easily accessible, affordable, and we're very close to having a sensitive test for Alzheimer's disease. And of course, treatment then can begin once we know what we're dealing with, often with lifestyle modification recommendations, the symptomatic therapies, in the future, the near future, disease-modifying therapies, and of course, always providing psychological support for the patient and the family, the care partners, and then making them aware of clinical trials that might be in the pipeline or might make drugs available in the pipeline to them.
In terms of making an early diagnosis and based on your own clinical experience, could you tell us about the benefits of starting treatment early?
Yeah, so that's a really important issue, Susan. When we think about kind of treating early, usually people are thinking about medications. And it is true that the symptomatic therapies that we have, the earlier we start them and we continue them over time, the more effectiveness, the more benefits we're going to see. But other benefits that often people don't think about relative to diagnosing people early in the course, early in that continuum of Alzheimer's disease, is that we get them at a time where they can still make decisions. They can decide what to do about end-of-life planning, about having a healthcare proxy, about maybe financial decisions, about updating their will if it hasn't been done. Those things can't be done later when the patient's already very advanced because they can no longer participate in those scenarios as well as they can in the early stages of the disease. So Susan, from your perspective as a care partner, do you have any thoughts on how improved recognition of early symptoms by the family physician or healthcare providers may have helped you, may have made a difference for you and your husband?
Well, I just think if he had been diagnosed earlier, we could have done more things with our life. He could have continued to work. It would have had to have been a lower level job, but he would have had the pleasure of working. We just would have had more time together. By the time he was finally diagnosed, he had already started to fade a little, and our time together was declining. So I would have liked to have had that extra time.
That sounds good. So, Susan, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and insights with us. Obviously, these kinds of conversations help us to better understand things from the caregiver perspective and what we in the Alzheimer's healthcare community can do better. How can we improve? How can we impact support to those seeking a diagnosis early as well as starting treatment early? So in this section, we're going to be discussing symptomatic treatment options in Alzheimer's disease. What are we learning from the latest data about transdermal as well as oral therapies? I think, as our audience knows, we don't have a cure for Alzheimer's disease. We do have recent data that have demonstrated a potential role for disease-modifying drugs or therapies. However, at the present time, most Alzheimer's patients are being treated with symptomatic therapies, which are either given as a tablet or a capsule or the newer kind of transdermal patches or therapies. So here we see in this graphic the currently approved symptomatic treatment options in Alzheimer's disease. I think, as we all know, the first cholinesterase inhibitor in common use was donepezil, which initially was only available as an oral tablet, but more recently came out as a once-a-week transdermal patch. Galantamine, another cholinesterase inhibitor, only available in either tablet form or kind of an oral solution, as well as an extended release form. The first cholinesterase inhibitor to be approved in a transdermal form was actually rivastigmine, which is available as an oral capsule or solution, but also is available as a daily transdermal patch. Memantine, which is the NMDA receptor antagonist, basically can be used together with the cholinesterase inhibitors, available usually as a tablet or a solution. And there's a newer preparation that combines fixed doses of donepezil as well as memantine. So, Susan, I just wanted to kind of pose a question to you. Can you tell us about your own experiences when your husband first started treatment? Were you offered any of the treatments that we've discussed in my previous introduction?
We simply had a drug called, and I'm going to mispronounce it, donepezil. That was the only thing on the market.
Oh, that's good.
And that was what my husband took. And I can't remember at this time whether he took it once a day or more often, but I do remember I had a huge box of vitamins and pills for him. And it was a big deal getting him to take these pills every day.
So just related to that, were you and your husband involved in the treatment decisions right from the start?
Absolutely. We had a great neurologist who sat with us and he sort of outlined what needed to be done, you know, in terms of personal, going to the CPA, going to the financial planner, telling our friends and our family, making decisions, and we did. And even at one point, my husband and I went and looked at assisted livings, and I said to him, you know, down the road, should it come to this, where would you like to go? So we were very much a team in the beginning. And we did a lot of work with the New York City Alzheimer's. He was actually the poster boy for him for a while. And it gave us a sense of control that we weren't just victims, which is really, really important. You know, as care partners and our loved ones, we have these conversations with healthcare professionals about specific treatment needs and expectations. I wonder what can be done to tailor treatment better, particularly in terms of symptom control.
Let's talk a little bit about current therapies, and we're kind of focusing on symptomatic therapy and how we kind of moved from the oral therapies, which I think your husband was on at that time, to the newer kind of transdermal symptomatic therapies. Keeping in mind that we only have two drugs, both of them are cholinesterase inhibitors, rivastigmine and donepezil, that are available in a transdermal form. As I mentioned earlier, rivastigmine was the first transdermal patch. It's a daily patch, and it was developed because rivastigmine in the oral form, whether capsules or liquid, had a lot of GI side effects, gastrointestinal side effects. And as we see here, there was a much lower rate of nausea, vomiting, gastrointestinal side effects with the transdermal patch. So that made a lot of sense, made it more accessible to a lot of people. After that kind of once-a-day patch, they also developed an even higher dose of the once-a-day patch and found that to be also very well tolerated. But I think a significant breakthrough occurred more recently with donepezil, where they were able to develop not a daily patch, but rather a patch that's good for a week. We know that it's very difficult sometimes to get Alzheimer's patients to take medications. They're already on a lot of medications, now an additional pill or capsule or tablet, whatever. Sometimes they have difficulties swallowing. There can be a number of issues. So having a patch available is obviously a big plus, not just because it's easier, has good acceptance, very high adherence, satisfaction on the part of patients and care partners, but it's also something that you don't have to swallow in addition to everything else. So the patch technology makes a lot of sense. Once a week patch technology makes it even easier, particularly for individuals who maybe are still taking their own medication but need reminders. You only have to remind them once a week, not every day. So that can be a real plus. So these are kind of more recent advances in symptomatic therapy. So in this next segment, we're going to be addressing shared management needs in Alzheimer's disease, kind of understanding the role of transdermal therapies. So shared management needs in Alzheimer's disease, you know, can be pretty complicated. I think it's important for healthcare professionals to provide meaningful support to help people living with Alzheimer's disease to really maximize their quality of life while sustaining and maintaining their functionality and lifestyle needs over time. And this is not easy. This requires obviously careful, thorough discussion with the care partner, the caregiver, to really provide the optimal level of care. So Susan, just to pose the first question to you, what do health professionals need to be aware of to provide meaningful support to patients with Alzheimer's disease and their care partners so that they are able to live and function well for as long as possible following diagnosis?
Well, I think one of the most important things is, and certainly everybody knows this is a long journey and it changes along the way. And so our healthcare providers have to help us as the continuum of care changes. In the beginning, everybody's there and there's a flurry of activities and things to do and tests, and then you come back for reevaluations. But by the time you hit middle stage, you're pretty much getting on your own. There aren't as many visits to the doctors, the support is less, and by the time you get down to end stage, you really are on your own. And so I think that those periods of time, caregivers need more support from their doctors. And be it maybe you have a nurse, practitioner, somebody that checks in with the caregiver to make sure that what's happening is going along right, but what about the health of the caregiver? How are they feeling? Are they able to cope? Are they burning out? Are they getting compassion fatigue? Those are all really important things that will affect the overall care of the patient. Based on your experience of supporting people with Alzheimer's disease, could you tell us how the different systematic therapies that you mentioned, both oral and transdermal options, can be used to support shared management needs?
Yeah, I think that's an important issue, Susan. So we're in the era, as we mentioned before, of symptomatic therapies. Whether we're looking at the oral preparations versus some of the newer kind of transdermal preparations, we emphasize, you know, the importance of early diagnosis. With early diagnosis, precise diagnosis, we can also begin early treatment, which is very important. And then we talked about the range of symptomatic treatment options, whether the cholinesterase inhibitors and or the NMDA receptor antagonist. I think we're moving toward preparations that have higher adherence rates. So we know there's data to show that there's higher patient and care partner satisfaction with the transdermal therapies. Initially, we only had a kind of a once a day, a 24-hour kind of transdermal preparation. But now we also have a once a week transdermal preparation, which makes it easier to remember, makes it less complicated to have to apply a patch every day versus kind of one day a week. And it will lead to hopefully higher adherence rates and more benefits for both patients as well as care partners. So I think we're moving toward an era when we are developing, hopefully, more effective symptomatic therapies and other modalities of administering these symptomatic therapies than we had available to us previously during the time when you were getting help for your husband.
Well, first of all, let me just ask. My husband's needs changed over time in terms of his symptoms and his ability to do everyday activities. How do you assess a patient's response to their treatment to ensure their needs continue to be met?
Yeah, so that's a really important question from the healthcare provider's perspective. One of the things that I believe in, and I mentioned this briefly earlier, is it's not a bad idea to administer some screening tools at baseline to get a feel for where the patient is cognitively, where they are relative to their activities of daily living, where they are maybe even behaviorally. So that once we introduce an intervention, we can re-screen or re-administer those tools to patients to see if perhaps we're stabilizing things, or maybe we've slowed the degree or the rate of progression, which might be very important. Now, of course, sometimes even after a good trial, which is usually a minimum of 6 months of any of the symptomatic therapies, both the patient as well as the care partner, as well as we as healthcare providers, are not happy, because we're not getting the stabilization or maybe slowing in the rate of progression that we'd like. In that case, we would think about switching to a different treatment, to a different symptomatic therapy, to see if we can gain more benefits. We always want to keep in mind that one of the reasons to stop any therapy would be intolerable side effects. So if someone has severe side effects from whatever agent that we're recommending, obviously we want to know about that. We need to recognize that right away and be able to maybe go to something that's going to be better tolerated. And I think now with the era of transdermal therapies, it is easier to have better tolerated medications than we had when we only had the oral preparations available to us.
Professor Grossbrook, how do you involve the patient and their care partner in decisions about ongoing treatment to better meet their unmet needs?
So that's a really important issue, Susan. One of the things that I really strongly believe in is from the very beginning in working with Alzheimer's patients and their care partners and their family, is that we have to develop a therapeutic alliance. We are all together on the same team. We are constantly communicating. We're constantly aware of what changes might be occurring, what needs might be different from time to time. But we are working toward the same goal. And the goal that we all share, and I tell this to patients and to families, because we don't yet have a cure. We don't yet have a way to halt the disease dead in its tracks. So our goal, our collaborative goal, is to really keep you as functional as possible for as long as possible. We want to be able to improve and maybe maintain your quality of life, or to perhaps decrease the rate of decline in, unfortunately, a progressive brain disease, which is what we have with Alzheimer's disease. So, Susan, I'm just wondering, are there any points from our conversation that kind of particularly resonate with your experiences? Any kind of final take-home points that you would like to share with our audience?
Absolutely. This concept of alliance with your healthcare provider is absolutely critical. In my book, My Life Rearranged, it wasn't just my life, it was my husband's life. I have a chapter on working with healthcare professionals, the various ones from physician, neurologist, psychologist. My expectations, their expectations, where I was right, where I was wrong, what I had to learn. This is so critical. It says it takes a village to raise a child. I believe it takes a village to take care of an Alzheimer's patient. And it's absolutely critical that we have a full team up and going. And I thank you for all that you're doing. And hopefully someday we won't even be having this discussion. Alzheimer's will be a thing of the past.
Thank you, Susan. I do want to formally thank Ms. Susan Miller for her time today and sharing her experiences with us to really help not only individuals who are dealing with Alzheimer's disease, to kind of put them at the front and center of our clinical conversations, but also hopefully our dialogue has been meaningful for healthcare providers, as well as for the many, many family members and care partners who are struggling to better deal with their loved ones with this devastating brain disease, namely Alzheimer's disease. So thank you again, Susan. Nice to be working with you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both our faculty, and thank you to our audience for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on Alzheimer's disease and related topics at Touch Neurology at www.touchneurology.com.